At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hey, this is Dr. Drew, and you are listening to This Life
with Bob Flores
and Dr. Drew.
Here we are. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, gather around the fireplace. The radio tubes
not a radio.
Getting...
Not a radio
the computer.
The computer. This is a podcast, Bob.
Well, it still has that feel.
Welcome to This Life Podcast. It's a Playroom Pods production produced by Susan Pinsky. I want to remind people that we did find an excellent sponsor that we can stand behind, the Rocky Mountain Treatment Center. They are a medically managed, high-intensity residential program. They have 30, 60, 90-day programs. They're up in Montana.
I know.
Outside of Bozeman. I've spoken to all their clinicians there, and they are abstinence exclusively.
Nice.
And I shared with the medical director, a physician there, my frustration with the direction our field has gone. The other voice you're hearing, of course, is Mackenzie Phillips, at Mac Phillips is her Twitter handle, M-A-C-K Phillips.
Hello.
I'll finish my diatribe about Rocky Mountain Treatment Center first. Partial hospitalization services, day treatment, they've got all the good stuff, but mostly I was impressed with their team. They are excellent. That's what makes a good program. And by the way, if you're up there in Bozeman, you're not thinking about going anywhere else.
So that's what I was going to say. They don't got a lot of competition up there.
No. But I was so stunned. I felt like I was talking to myself when I talked to the medical director. He says he was talking about going to the meetings,
ASAM
and whatever meetings, and he was like, "Oh, it's so depressing." I thought, "Yes, it's awful." And he goes, "I feel like I'm a so lonely voice, and I can't get heard, and they're going off marching off in this other direction." And there it is. Now, Mac, bring us up. Oh, by the way, before I go into Mac's story, I want to please support us by checking out the Amazon banner at drdrew.com. Remember, it costs you nothing to click through, but it pays Caleb Nation, who's our webmaster, incredible guy. Also, shout out to Valerie on PR for continued support of the show. Last but not least, be sure to listen to Dr. Drew Podcast and the Adam and Drew Podcast on Corolla Digital. Is that enough there? Thank you, Bob.
That's why you're a professional.
You're good, Drew.
No, that's my wife. That's Susan, our producer, giant wooden spoon she's hanging over my head. So I'm normally the least promotional guy. I just can't do it.
No, but you have an ability to be very fluid with that stuff.
Well, she wrote it all out. It's all good. So
you're a good reader.
Thank you, Mac. So, Mac, bring us up today. People who haven't been with you the way we all have been the last couple of years, tell people where you've been and what's been going on.
Well, you know, what can I say? I've been working. I went back to school, and I became a counselor, and I've been working at Pasadena Recovery Center as a primary counselor for the last 3 years.
It's been awesome.
It's been incredible. I'm so grateful to them for inspiring me to follow my passion.
And now you're moving on to a program called Breathe.
I'm moving to Breathe Life Healing Center. Tomorrow morning, people, will be my first day at my new job, and I'm absolutely thrilled to join the team over there. And
the first thing I noticed with Mac, I haven't seen you really quietly. We've seen a conference and things.
Events,
we have to speak and stuff.
Yeah.
But how great does she look?
Yeah,
how healthy
she's
does
great
she look?
Health and she comes,
oh my God,
she doesn't come at you the way she used to.
Well, oh my God.
She used to come at you with all kinds of agendas.
Oh, those were the days, huh?
Yeah, and remember when we took the walk around at Celebrity Rehab and we went around the block and I said, don't do this book thing, don't do it.
Yeah.
And you were like, I have to do it.
She'd already done it at that point.
That person is not around anymore.
And you know what? It turned out to be not a bad decision to do the book.
I know, but I felt like beating some people up.
I was in favor of it.
I felt like beating some people up. I feel like my little sister all... You know what I
crack
mean?
Them
that
over
was
the
a
head.
Rough week for you when that book came out.
That
wasn't
was
it?
That was tough. I mean, I seriously had. I guess I was kind of naive, and I thought, well, the people who love me will love me, regardless of whether or not I speak my truth. And boy, was I wrong. They'll love me from, oh, way over there, maybe.
Trust everyone, trust no one.
My idealism and my altruism has gotten me in more sticky wickets than you can possibly imagine.
We call that codependency.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I'm very familiar with that territory.
I'd rather call it idealism and altruism.
But hey, listen, that's why, by the way, hold on. Yeah. Codependency is not a strictly negative thing. It directs you towards altruism, which I always value.
Right.
So it's a liability that comes with a strength.
There you go. Yeah, okay. So. Spoken by Dr. Drew.
There you go.
But what was funny is the way the wind blew about the subject of the book. If it, show business is so phony, half the people that were kind of not unkind to you would have been kind to you if there was like this warm, oh yeah, all the things that you thought were going to happen.
Exactly.
That's what I hate about Hollywood.
So what do you mean? I don't understand
what you mean. If the reaction of the family had been what I had expected it to be, everyone would have been really nice about it.
Yeah.
You know, across the board. And you know, I had people say to me, well, why did you wait till he was dead? And if I had written it when he was alive, they would have said, why didn't you wait until he, you know?
Yeah, that's true.
Do you know what I mean?
See that?
You can't.
I don't think you can win.
No, there was no win with that.
But people,
but it was courageous and it was brave, and it goes on a lot more in America than people ever want to talk about.
Drew was my champion. You were so helpful and so inspirational.
I don't know where I was. I was literally out in the world when I saw you talking to Oprah. And I was like, oh, shit, here it goes.
That was so scary.
Oh, my God. I'm like, oh, crap. I just froze in the spot. I just remember it. But you looked so...
My hands were shaking.
No, but, Mac, you looked so connected and so... and when people started questioning the veracity and stuff, like, come on, everybody just watch what Mac is saying.
I remember they had like a lie to me person, like a person who reads body language on ET or Access Hollywood or something.
No.
And they were like, well, all we can say is... She believes that it's true. That's all they could say.
Well, good. That's all we need to say.
Does America not know, Drew, what we know?
About how much sexual abuse there is.
No.
I think they when it comes to close family, they recoil. I think people understand that it happens with strangers and neighbors and teachers and doctors and blah, 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 blah. But when it's immediate family.
It's always immediate family.
No, it isn't always. It's often teachers and stuff like that. But when it's immediate family, I mean like immediate family, that's when people are, ugh! And I hear about it on radio all the time.
I'm sure you do all the time.
Every night.
You know where I hear it the most is stepfathers and teenage daughters and stuff like that.
Are you okay talking about this, by the way?
Oh, absolutely.
I did not expect us to go down this path. What?
Nor did I, but that's fine.
No, it's a courage that she had that no other American has.
I think she blew it up. I feel like we're talking about it now. We were beginning to, and Max just poof.
Well, what happened after High on Arrival came out was that a lot of people went, oh, me too.
Oh, yeah.
And then another person would, you know, put their hand up and go, oh, me too. Like, a lot of people started.
I would argue that before you did that, I'd have to extract it from people.
Yes.
No one would come forward with it. And when they would come forward, it was very shame-based stuff, which, of course, it's a shaming experience. But now they're much more, I wouldn't say matter of fact, but apt to be understanding that it's not something that only happened to them or that it was their responsibility.
Absolutely. I mean, I have so many clients sitting, you know, come to my office, young heroin addicted women who, you know, it is, it's like extracting the truth from them. And the shame and the fear and the belief that because you didn't scream and yell or run or tell or, you know, pull out a stick that you're complicit.
Well,
you're responsible.
And I think that's the part, Bob, that people really had trouble getting their head around with Mac, which is the sort of Stockholm syndrome she got into.
Yeah.
People cannot get that. They don't understand it unless they've been there.
That's right. And, you know, being a counselor now and being, you know, a hopeful healer, I like to say, you know, and having gone through this experience, you know, quite literally and then in the public eye, it gives me sort of a unique perspective on how to talk to young women about this trauma.
How would you describe that? Because that fascinates me.
Well, you know, I mean, I can actually, you know, an appropriate disclosure is always very interesting when you're working as a counselor or
when to disclose is an art.
When to disclose is a real art. So, you know, to say, you know, I have some of this in my history as well, and I can tell you for me, when I finally came to terms with the fact that I was medicating my trauma with heroin and, you know, cocaine or whatever, that as I started to let go of my coping mechanism and I started to like really feel the deep trauma of what had happened in my life, I needed someone to be there for me and someone who was just going to listen. And I'd like to be that person for you.
Very powerful.
And what I...
And being that person, by the way, I would argue that to the extent that you take care of yourself and not get evoked, being on the other side can be very healing too. It's another phase of your healing.
Absolutely. That's what I think happened, which is the event of the book, immediately Max started working in treatment,
It's,
laying low,
healing
yourself, learning your craft. And now she's popping out the other side, and now it's all, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
that's what I feel like. If that had, if the book hadn't happened, I don't think you'd be a counselor.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I don't think I would either. I mean, I started going to school for KDAC certification in 2003.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
You were not ready.
I was not.
By the way.
Apparently, I was so not ready.
She was a periodic at that time.
Actually, absolutely.
But you know what? I see that now in retrospect as all part of the arc of your healing.
Yes.
Really what it is. That was okay that you did that because you were in that phase of, you were moving towards it.
I was moving towards
the units. Yeah. For later on.
You know what? I let him go.
You did?
I let him go and started all over.
Smart. Where did you go?
Smart.
No, I went to a hybrid program at Sober College called ICDS. It's a certification.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's a really quick...
Oh, that Sober College place. Even though I love what they do, you live out near there, right?
I don't. I live in Sherman Oaks. They're in Woodland Hills.
I know,
but that's just okay. 818.
It's a valley.
Yes, yes. Deep 818.
Deep 818.
See, that's a valley girl.
I know.
Who knows it? You know, it's, that's 8 miles west.
Exactly.
To me, it's all out there.
Never the twain shall meet. I remember once I was dating a guy, or I was about to date a guy, and I met him at a meeting. You guys know him. I won't say his name on here. But I was like, oh, well, here's my number. Call me. And he goes, oh.
818.
818. And I said, well, it's Tarzan. And he goes, oh, deep 818. I'm like, fine, whatever. I still went to bed with him. What can I say?
But the Sober College, have you ever been out there?
No.
It's out past Encino. Yeah,
I've heard about it. Yeah, it's like Woodland Hills. Yeah.
But it's inspiring and it's depressing.
Oh.
Because that population, they have a wall of all the dead kids.
Oh.
It's just so depressing. And the first time I was there, it was at a memorial for a friend of mine's daughter. Mm. And I was just like, oh my God, I don't think I could do this.
They're doing great work.
Well,
yeah,
no, what
they
do you
are.
Mean? You can't do it. You do it all the time.
No, but it's just dealing with it. Well, no, what a treatment center does. I'm dealing with the semi-surrendered. You know what
it's
I mean?
A new category.
I still, by the way, one of the greatest recovery stories for me is Mac going to that place that the nun ran, your first sobriety.
Oh, she wasn't a nun, but Mrs. Delaney.
She'd been a nun or something, right?
Well, she wasn't a nun. No, she was like Marty Mann. She was one of those type of women in the early days.
But she walked through a doorway that said, it had an inscription over it that said, let me see if I get this right, for the reluctant to recover. Right?
Yes.
Right? I thought, oh my God, that's the best.
And then I walked further into the room and there were signs that said, you know, let go and let God, think was upside down. And then there was one that said one day at a time. And I went, oh, they knew I was coming. Yeah.
Did anyone ever get that whoever wrote that or created that show was in AA? Did anybody ever get it?
I don't know.
It had to have been.
Well, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of recovery speak out there that it's goes
the
under 70s? The radar. Yeah, but
I just always assume there was some sober writer guy trying to sneak stuff
in.
I think they had a family member who had.
Yeah.
It's so interesting.
Thing.
We had a CEO at the hospital we worked at for years and years. And as soon as he got there, you weren't there yet. And he started using a couple of aphorisms that we're all used to from the program. And everyone went, oh my God. And I was like, no way. Come on. And more started coming. I was like, oh, okay. Well, that's that.
And he got it. So
He
was in the program.
Yeah. You know that.
Oh, yeah. I knew that, but not a very good program.
Well, how dare you? How dare you?
But, you know, DeAndre Jordan, I just came from the Clippers-Cleveland game.
Oh, yeah. How
DeAndre
fun.
Jordan has the Serenity Prayer tattooed on his arm. And I happened to be right next to him one time. I said, AA? And he just looked like...
Who are you?
It wasn't. He just likes the prayer, I guess.
Oh, my God. That's so funny.
Wow.
But what I'm saying is Sober College and a lot of these programs, they're the unsurrendered. They're filled with unsurrendered kids.
We certainly
Just there out of coercion, failure to launch, blah, blah, blah. There's a little bit of that at PRC.
Yeah.
But it's so hard to deal with kids who have not even contemplated stopping, but they'll give you lip service that they're stopping because their moms want them to.
And here's the deal. What always amazed me is that a client will present as so well and so motivated, and, you know, and they'll be sitting there in the office and they're like, well, you know, I'm really excited to go out and work a rigorous program of honesty, you know, program. And I'm thinking to myself, they think that I can... that I have control.
That you believe them.
Well, they think that I believe them, for one, but they also think that if your counselor believes you, your counselor believes you, then maybe they can talk your parents into not re-upping you for another month.
I think it's a little deeper than that. I think if they can convince you, it helps them believe their own bullshit.
Well, yes.
They know they're bullshitting. They know they can't believe anything comes out of their own mouth.
Yeah.
But should we even be in a position when a 17 or 18 or 19-year-old kid is talking AA speak to us?
Yeah.
There is no way to even comprehend it.
What do you mean?
At 17, 18.
Though they can't get it?
What being an addict means, I've seen surrender, suffering.
I've seen some get it.
She just got sober 5 or 6 years ago. I got sober when I was 35. People don't get sober when they're 17, 18. And when they do, they're an exception. Everybody points at them saying, oh, a 17-year-old can get sober. Yeah. It's a fucking lie. Yeah. No, they can't. We have to decide what we're going to do.
Well, you're building a case for my profession to step in and do
that's
what I'm.
Then. That's why I. That
that's
he
scary.
Bit on my. He bit on my apple right now.
Sneaky,
so
sneaky.
Did you see the 2020 show last night?
We'll talk about it. No, I didn't.
I DVR'd it. I can't watch this shit.
I can't watch it.
It's Suboxone all the way. Yeah. I don't think Suboxone is either. There has to be a middle way, a new way for these kids. And maybe Sober College will figure it out, I hope. But putting 17, 18, 19-year-old kids and expecting them to say and do and hit all the right emotional meters, life beats, the Mackenzie Phillips and Bob Forrest and Bob Timmons and all these 40-year-old people that got sober, it's unfair to them. Do you understand, Drew?
Yes. It is unfair to them.
I don't.
Because you weren't listening.
I kind of was. In this society, we treat 19, 20-year-olds like they're 11. And then all of a sudden, we want them to really understand some deeply profound thoughts about existence, meaning, and purpose.
Yeah, yeah.
They're incapable of it.
But
because the only way you understand that is by suffering from your disease.
But then bring this in, okay? They're going to die.
Drew's going to feel hopeless in a second.
He's building a case for Suboxone.
I know.
You're building the case. But
they won't stay on Suboxone. They're taking benzos and coke and you know what I mean?
Yeah, but the reality is Suboxone does work for some people in an intermediate term sort of way, right? It does work. People do get better. They do.
Now, Trexone works.
No, Suboxone. No. It's not as though Suboxone never works. It's just that people never get off of it. They never really come to terms with what's going on with them. And they're always on a slippery ground. Now, people would argue that at least they're getting back to work and they're functioning in their families and stuff. And they can do some kind of cognitive behavioral therapies and things. And who are we to say, you and me, to say that they should have to go for an abstinence-based program? We are interested in complete flourishing. We're interested in the likes of what's sitting next to us here, Mac Phillips.
Yeah.
We're interested in restoring people to a completely, actually better than they ever knew they could be.
Right.
That's what we're excited about. That's what we're interested in doing. But the question becomes, and this is what, as a scientist, I have to ask myself all the time, are we doing some a disservice by insisting upon that? And the answer is yes. We're doing some a disservice. So then it becomes, well, how do we select the ones that can't, that not realistic for them to get better? And those should be on Suboxone.
Is anybody studying this 47,000 young people dying every year?
No, what's happening is everybody's going to Suboxone, and that's the problem.
Yeah. So Suboxone is not the answer if all the kids are dying.
Well, and by the way, people that want to, here's another thing, guys.
If it's a miracle cure, then why are all the kids dying?
I understand. Believe me, it doesn't. It's not. It's delaying the inevitable. In my humble opinion,
we're getting into the meat and potatoes of American addictions.
But here's the craziness. Right, here's the craziness. In my opinion, the public at large goes, oh, it's the drug companies that are pushing the doctors to prescribe those opiates.
No, they aren't.
Drug companies can't even give us pens anymore. It's the doctor is not understanding what addiction is, having satisfaction surveys. Remember when Bruce sat here and told us about that?
Yeah.
Satisfaction surveys. If the patient doesn't fill out a positive satisfaction survey, you lose your job. You lose the access to the insurance. You literally shit
but
out of luck.
But it's a new specialty to just have a Suboxone dispensary. It's a whole. It's like being an orthopedist.
Let me finish my story. So it's not the Vicodin, it's not the oxycodone manufacturers, it's the physicians themselves that have to make patients happy, that don't even understand how to confront this, or they cast the patient out as a bad patient, and they turn to heroin at that point, of course. But the intermediate step is, and this is the, I don't want to say it's the evil part, but this is the pernicious part, is here's where the pharmaceutical company steps in, Suboxone. That is being pushed by the pharmaceutical company and the government
The
physicians.
Yeah.
And legally so. Literally, somebody like me, by going for an abstinence treatment, is taking huge risk legally because now the Suboxone has become standard of care. And you and I have agreed that for chronic pain patients, might not be such a bad alternative.
I'm open to any solution where less kids die next year.
Yes.
And I, you know what I mean?
Done and done. but the point
is... But what
is
it, though? That's
no, we have those things, but
At what cost?
At what cost? At what cost? At what cost, not just from a standpoint of resources, but at what expense to the individual? Are we just going to make them chronically ill? Are we going to really try to make them well? I mean, imagine if you had access to Suboxone 10 years or whenever you got...
I was on Subutex
maintenance.
She was on it.
Subutex for...
How was that?
I hated it.
Yeah. Suboxone is a little different. It feels a little different, apparently. But people that are non-addicts that have been exposed to it feel like just wasted.
Yeah.
So it's not like it's nothing.
I
wish you guys would watch this show. I can't believe it. The kids are so high. I'm just sitting there going,
you could see
that kid,
they were.
And they're presenting him as sober.
Yeah, yeah.
His eyes are so pinned. His affect is so flat.
Yeah.
He's so high that he's not only just high on Suboxone, he's high on
benzos,
dope, too.
Benzos.
Yeah, yeah.
We take a quick break. We're taking a break. We'll be right back.
All conversations and information exchanged during participation in the This Life with Dr. Drew and Bob Forrest podcast or interaction with drdrew.com website is intended for educational and entertainment purposes only. Do not confuse this with treatment or medical advice or direction per se. Nothing on these podcasts or posted on this site supplements or supersedes the relationship and direction of your medical caretakers. Although Dr. Drew is a licensed physician with specialty board certifications by the American Board of Internal Medicine and the American Board of Addiction Medicine, he is not functioning as a physician in this environment. The same applies to any professionals who may appear on the sites or podcasts.
We're back with more of This Life. Mackenzie Phillips is our guest today. Everyone knows Mac. Mac, where can people find your website or anything like that?
Oh, I don't have a website, but...
the Breathe website, I imagine.
You could go to BreatheLifeHealingCenter.com, or you could go to Twitter... Instagram, Facebook, Mac, M-A-C-K Phillips.
And I want to say something that I'm going to say repeatedly to our listeners, which is a lot of people have logged on to my website and sent us emails. And there's a whole thing about emails. A, we are reading them. Susan is sending them to me. And B, I can't legally actually respond on the web.
I can.
You could. But my license doesn't permit that. My practice doesn't permit. So I have to sort of... compile them and sort of answer questions like that, but I can talk about them on this podcast. So some of you guys will get yours specifically read, and then we can say, you know, in cases like this, here's how we approach it. And here's a good one. This is from, I'll tell you who it's from, Christopher. And he says, moment of clarities. All right. What triggered the feeling of the cleansing? What a release. I'm a podcast listener, blah, blah, blah. He said it took it three times to get this moment of clarity. What about moments of clarity? What do you guys think those are?
I think everybody has them lots of different ways, and the 12-step community places a huge emphasis on it. But I've had them, and I'm sure you've had them, and then you just use again 3 months later.
Yes. and then there are those sort of stellar moments of clarity that lead to a behavior change, that lead to even pre-contemplation, you know.
Yeah.
But those sort of get lost in the miasma of the next shot for a lot of people.
That is And so wouldn't you say that in all, as we look at that case of somebody who has a clarity, gets with it, and then 3 months later is using, what went wrong?
Well, I think it's, I don't really need to do anything.
No action is taken.
So they're not ready. Yeah. They're not ready.
So I do this exercise now.
Well, what can we do, though? You see? Well,
I'll show you. Right. There's this. I did this exercise. I'm running outpatient groups down in Tustin. I asked the clients to get on a scale of 1 to 10, because they all know the pain scale. So yeah. I always use the 1 to 10 scale.
Right.
On a scale of 1 to 10, what's your level of your surrender, and what's the level of your willingness? And then I go all the way around the room, and they're always pretty lined up, like a 6 and a 6 or a 7 and a 6 and whatever. And I go, well, there's no way of quantifying or even knowing what the surrender scale. It's actually just philosophical, subjective thing.
So,
but
you don't
willingness,
know.
We can measure. Okay. We can actually see you go to meetings.
Right.
We can see you do your assignments. We can see you go to bed at 11 o'clock when you're supposed to. We can see and quantify willingness.
Yeah.
We cannot. So that thing of like the epiphany that changed me so much.
Yeah.
I always think that if people verbalize it, it's probably not true.
I think, you know, it's really important. As you're walking through this process with someone, to try and redirect them and realign them to what is, not what magical thinking is telling them it could be. What is, you know, what is the reality in this moment? You know, safety and stabilization has to have a component of the awareness of the isness of things. Where, you know, and I always say, what makes this make sense? What makes you sitting across from me, you know, here in this office on this day, make sense? You
That's
know,
a great question.
If in fact we're here today by way of everywhere we've been, then let's talk about how we got here and how we can redirect ourselves.
It's a great little technique.
That's what I use. Nice. That's one of the things I like to do.
Yeah, I've noticed the kinds of things. I've spoken about this before.
But wait, let me say, if you're dealing with someone who's just turned 18, and you know, and they don't even know what the fuck you're talking about.
They don't know.
Pardon me. You know,
is that our educational system? Is it our family systems? Which is worse? Both?
I think it's the victim system, that everybody's a victim. Like, you know what I mean? So you get a free pass from responsibility. Do you understand? Rehab has almost become like an obfuscation now.
How's that?
Because you don't have to be responsible for yourself.
Oh, you
just go from one
three
to
hots
the next
and a cot.
To the actor.
Yep.
It's more than three hots and a cot. It's three hots and some psychobabble and a cot.
And some Suboxone.
And they start to believe it, right?
So they're institutionalized almost.
Yes. By for-profit rehab.
When things get bad, mom and dad throw me in rehab, and then everything's okay for a little while.
Then
maybe
I complain.
Right.
Then
and I get my car back, and I get my, you know, apartment back.
She just lived through it for 3 years.
Like, literally.
It's all goals-based. Like, I get my car back, I get my phone back, I get this back, you're going to help me, I want to go to this sober living because I heard it's good.
Right.
I've heard that 10,000 times.
I want to be by the beach.
They heard it's good. They've heard that.
Well, now, it seems like Jason's got something a little different going on, right?
Yeah, it's very proactive.
Jason
Waller.
Waller, I love that guy.
But he's we had him on a little while ago, and he has a whole program going on where he seems like he gets them engaged. Genuinely engaged, ones that are sort of like this, resistant, like you're describing.
So he's not at Northbound anymore. No. He's doing his own thing.
But they have to sign up for that. And so many of these kids are not going to sign up for that. That's why he has a...
But isn't it interesting, Bob?
We call it 30 and dirty.
But what we have trouble reaching...
Yeah, going back.
You like it?
But what we have trouble reaching is these adolescents, which is that's what they are. I mean, they may be 25, but they're still adolescent. Because we're used to engaging in a very deep way and helping people sort of deal with trauma, blah, blah, blah. And they can't necessarily do that. Isn't it interesting that having a social group that sweeps them along, very much the way adolescents behave, that's what's having some effect on them? So
I think the
answer is this kind of thing for these resistant young people.
You know, like how they have in Norway, they have like a little village that they've created for people with Alzheimer's, and there's a supermarket, and there are helpers, and there are people that get them, you know, get them what they need. Maybe there's some idea of like sober villages for adolescents.
Sober college, right?
College.
But I'm thinking on a more
like
more
the
living,
Minnesota
living,
model.
Yeah.
That's this thing is what Jason's doing is get out, get a job, go surfing, be a part of the community, all that kind of stuff. That takes is so labor intensive.
Yes. Yes, it is.
He's not making a penny.
Well, but I understand, but he's got the other kids sweeping them along with them. You know what I mean? I mean, it's not just him.
Eventually, it should grow and then have a life of its own, right? That. So the reason why I bring it up is because this Suboxone, this 2020 thing was all young people, pregnant people with kids, and all. You guys got to see. You're both the leading people in your field, Bob, and you didn't watch it.
Bob, I can't watch that stuff. I can't do it. It makes me insane. I literally like want to jump out of my skin.
It makes me sad.
I texted you. Are you watching this bullshit? You said I can't. It makes me sick.
It makes me sick.
Yeah. What about it makes you sick?
It's gonna sound. It's gonna sound ridiculous and grandiose, but we know a little better.
Yeah.
We know there's a better way, and these people just don't have any experience. The people who are advocating this as exclusive treatment. They're scientists. They're neurobiologists. I get it. I'm that too. But I also know that there's something more of the mind and the interpersonal experience and the flourishing that's necessary to really have a full recovery. I know it. We've done it for decades.
Then
and they don't have any experience or knowledge about
then
it.
Then I have to ask you, what do you think of the Core 12 track?
Which is what?
At Hazel and Betty Ford.
Core 12. Help
that the, okay, so
we're going to have a guy from Hazel in here. We'll ask him about it.
Okay, so they decided to do a track for Suboxone maintenance.
Yeah, listen.
So like literally a separate track.
Good.
Well, there's been thoughts of creating a whole 12-step kind of community where it's not intermingled with the abstinence.
It needs a separate thing.
It has its own world.
Because if you're in a treatment center and some people are on Suboxone maintenance and some people aren't,
run that.
It's a nightmare.
You
have to have a separate track for it. You have to have separate groups for it.
Just so you know, when we were running a program, I would not allow, if they wanted Suboxone, they had to go to another part of the hospital. Because as soon as anybody sniffed the possibility.
Everybody wants it.
Everybody's like, well, I'm not getting it. Blah, 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 blah.
Exactly.
And you can't do anything. The program falls apart.
You can't because no one can focus. Everyone's distracted on meds.
Same thing of
benzos. But they're all feeding out. Let's face it. After 30 or 60 or 90 days, they're feeding out of these programs on Suboxone into AA.
I understand
you know
that.
What I mean? So
I'm in favor of a separate track for it because for some people it's going to be life-saving. You have to accept that. The criticism I have is that we're not skilled in whom we select to use it on.
Correct.
And there are lots of people whose lives are being rendered chronically ill who really would make wonderful, flourishing, different people.
With an end date, with a stop date.
I know, never.
That'll never happen.
Well, that's what Core 12 is at Hazel and Betty Ford, is that they follow them for 12
months. I want my
start
months. Date good. 2 years out.
Right.
It's good. Well, that's good.
I had a boyfriend who was on Suboxone. And
could he function sexually, or is it screw him all
He
up?
Could function sexually. Yeah. He was a maniac.
Yeah.
But
that was so clinical how you guys just talked about that.
Except for the maniac part. Except for the maniac part. But like then I'm like, I come out of the bathroom and he's smoking a cigarette and he's about to set the bed on fire. And I broke up with him that day. I said, you know what, this is, I can't.
The maniac, by the way, the maniac part was probably had delay and probably couldn't feel satisfied and all
right.
that kind of stuff.
Exactly.
All right, let's talk about cannabis a little bit.
Okay.
Okay, I've got another email. See this from a Molly. Somebody who's addicted to marijuana. I've chosen to write to you and ask you specifically perhaps to engage in a small debate on which side of marijuana should fall when treating addiction. I want to ask if I think what she's talking about. Now, first of all, marijuana, this business about marijuana addictive or not is bizarre, right? We've all seen marijuana addiction, right?
Absolutely.
Okay, right. And it's different. Every addiction to every chemical
See, I think
is different.
But let's clarify.
But
I
people
think most people think in terms of heroin addiction, right?
Yes, it's different than that.
It's like alcoholism. It's exactly.
It's
people
very similar.
Function on it.
Well, not only that, people can stop drinking by themselves. It's something called natural recovery. It's actually been recorded. I mean, they're not fully flourishing, but they're not drinking. And same thing happens with pot. People just stop for periods of time. That
but
does
the
happen.
Pot thing is on that same continuum. There's the downtown hobos and the violent, you know,
same as
rednecks.
Alcohol. Same as alcohol.
And and there's this other version, the functioning version.
Right.
Right.
People can smoke a lot of pot and be fine. But that's just true.
And then if they're like my son went to Japan a year ago and he smokes weed. And he was like in Japan and, you know, he was with his dad on a big rock and roll tour. And he was like, no weed. It's Japan. Mm. And Shane said I was fine. You know?
Didn't get depressed?
No. I mean, he was out like looking at the Harajuku girls, you know?
I've had, Drew, depression is a major part of marijuana. I'll just give you examples that I know. All the kids are young people. I've never seen like a 70-year-old or 50-year-old old hippie stop smoking pot and go to rehab. But young people I have, and they report feeling depressed during withdrawal.
Oh, of course.
Depressed for months afterwards. But watch this. Friend of mine who'd been smoking it for years had a kid, and the wife said no more smoking pot in the house, and it was outside in the snow. Yeah. He said he felt new vitality, so positive, yeah, so great.
Sure.
Same, but Drew, using for the same amount of time.
It's very different in different people.
So it's just relative to the physiology of the
individual.
The person.
That's why I always say there's no such thing as a bad drug and a good drug. It's the relationship of that individual with that chemical. That's yes. what the. But let me read you another one. This is from Stefan or Stephen. And this is real, the real deal. Listen to this.
Pot,
this
then?
Yeah, real deal. 8 to 10 joints a day. Been to outpatient twice. I'm so extreme right now. I'm spending $120 to $220 a day for his use. He should get a marijuana card.
Wow.
Oh, he's in Iowa somewhere. He's out in the Midwest somewhere. I tried going to Marijuana Anonymous, but there's only one meeting in his area. So he's motivated. He wants to try, but he's severely addicted. That's there it is. That's the real
deal.
Do
you have insurance?
Yeah, that's the question. And he's Midwest. Go up to Minnesota. Go up to Hazleton.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's people were like, what, for marijuana? How dare you? That's the real deal, right?
Yeah. That's the real deal.
Yeah.
And he will be depressed when he's in detox.
Oh, he'll be agitated, irritable, and be a little paranoid even.
Things.
No sleep for 3 months.
Right.
And that's the way that works. But that doesn't mean that pot is not a bad drug. Doesn't mean that everybody should not smoke pot. It means that guy should not smoke pot.
There you go.
So are there some people that should take heroin? Because I'd like to sign up.
But wait a minute.
Are you with me?
But yeah, sure, why not? Let's go.
But here's a more difficult question.
Are there some people that could be on, because in that philosophy?
No. Well, because that's a different biology. But here's a
not
more.
Not even Keith Richards?
But let me ask you. Oh.
I don't think he does it anymore.
No,
does
he doesn't.
Yeah.
But let me ask you a more challenging question, which is, let's say you are a severe heroin addict. Is there a role for marijuana maintenance? Think marijuana instead of heroin. You switch over, you cross addict to marijuana. Let me ask it this way. Would you rather the patient be on marijuana or Suboxone?
Marijuana.
Me too.
100%. Yeah,
wow. Me too.
So you know what's funny, though? Let's just go to a side personal note. I say Keith Richards all the time. Do I know? He's one of my all-time heroes.
Yeah.
When Mac was here, I just realized, oh my God, she grew up with him.
You did?
Shit. I did.
In her house all the time.
Did. Yeah.
He's a human being to her. He's just Keith Richards to me.
Do you know how many times? I can't talk to Bob for 3 minutes without Keith Richards coming up.
I'm telling you, when my dad and I, it was like 1980 after my dad got arrested for trafficking, and he was,
As is the custom.
As is the custom, yes.
like everyone's dad.
Just like your dad. I remember I was at a Stones show, and we were backstage, and Keith, forgive me, he'll get a kick out of this if he ever hears it, which he won't. He walked up to me with a mirror with like a little pyramid of cocaine on it.
Yeah.
And he went, "Can you say no now, love?" And I went, and I just blew it all over the floor.
When was that?
When?
Yeah.
81, maybe?
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Yeah. I just blew it all over the floor. But
you grew up with him around your house, right?
Yes.
Yeah,
he and my dad were like looking through the carpet for little pieces of.
Made a record.
How do you figure he survived through all this?
Keith? You know, like you said, it's a physiology. It's that individual.
Yeah,
I mean, I haven't seen him in
decades. And to be fair, the thing that really puts rocket fuel behind addiction is trauma. And if you're an addict without trauma, it's a slightly different phenomenon, I would argue.
Yeah,
but still an addict. But yeah, that's the thing that I know a little bit about Keith Richards. His dad's his best friend. They get along.
Yeah, he's not a trauma survivor.
The only trauma he reports is growing up during World War II.
Except for that.
just a little thing.
He was in Aleppo during Syrian.
You know that there was like 4 and 5 year old kids going down in bomb shelters.
I know that.
And people in America
But that actually is a different kind of trauma.
What kind of trauma is it?
I was just going to bring up the different kind of trauma because when we look at this thing of addiction feeding trauma, right? We can have a kid who, you know, my parents were, you know, I got everything I wanted. I lived in a really nice house and, you know, I went to the best schools. And when I turned 18, I got a Maserati or whatever, right? What was missing? The parents were always at work.
Yeah.
They were, it's
abandonment, which is traumatic.
So trauma is relative to the person too. So yes, what might be traumatic to me.
Great point.
Might not be traumatic to somebody else, and
absolutely
vice versa.
True. Absolutely true. But there is such a thing as shattering trauma.
Yes, there definitely
is. But what is that whole generation? So all the kids that were living in London and Liverpool, I mean, historically we know them, the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and a lot of that generation.
Yeah.
They're running down to bomb shelters, real bombs, yeah. Not just teachers telling you get under the desk, let's have a practice in case there's a nuclear attack.
Yeah.
This is happening to them on a nightly basis.
Yeah.
What is the trauma on that generation?
PTSD.
Yeah, it can be a PTSD, but my
I believe it made them all narcissists and want to be successful.
No, I think it made them antisocial because their whole thing was, you know, hey, fuck the man, fuck everything.
Right.
Well, they did a good job of making money off that attitude.
Right, well, because a lot of people adopted that. So there was a big antisocial sort of movement on the heels.
So do you think the audience was also trauma survivors?
Oh, yeah. Well, they're all...
It all fit. The 60s generation, it all fit.
Yeah, because from here, on our end, it was a bunch of GIs coming home with PTSD and trauma, beating the shit out of their kids and whatever, and demanding them to be like Marines or whatever it was.
Yeah.
That got transmitted then to our population as well. And so, perfect. The guys were actually going in the probably it's worse having your dad be like, but they probably had their fair share of that stuff too, right?
Because it's a phenomenon that hit in 1963, 64, 65.
Yeah.
And all those people were World War II.
Well, what
affected.
I've always said, how bizarre.
Subversives.
Yes. What's so bizarre to me that in the 70s, when I was an adolescent, the people that were most revered were the most subversive and the most antisocial and the most alternative. Not alternative the way you think about it in the 90s. I mean like the 60s alternative. And those were the people. We went from putting Jimmy Stewart on a pedestal to...
Jimi Hendrix.
Jimi Hendrix was the beginning. You know what I mean? It got a lot worse. This was as good as it got. You know what I mean? These were the people we revered and put.
So who are you referring to in the mid-70s? Like who? Like Abby Hoffman?
Just think of anybody. Who was the student body president of your high school when you were there? Think of who that we put in that.
John Monroe.
What was he like?
He was a stoner and didn't give a fuck.
that's what mine. Bob, that was mine too. In 1974. That was it, man.
Valerie Bertinelli was the president of my class. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah, there were five of you at the
just
school.
Just the two of us.
In the trailer, right.
Just two of us, yeah.
But that's exactly my point.
No, you know, there's Todd Bridges, the two
exactly.
of you.
Dana Plato.
Oh, Jesus.
Danny Bonaducci. Oh, my God, what a high school.
but listen, roll it back 15 years before that. Who would have been the student body president?
Oh, the cool...
Betty Crocker.
Yeah, the most prim and proper.
So we just went whoosh, all of a sudden. And we are still the owners of all that change. That's why I take aim at the 70s. It's such a shitty time.
I loved the 70s.
Shitty things happened to you in the 70s.
You know...
And it was all endorsed by the culture of the time.
Well, yes, that's true, but...
But it was so fun.
Wasn't it fun, though?
See, you weren't at the bowling alley, Drew. You were at home reading books.
Yes.
We were at the bowling alley.
We were.
And shit was going on.
You were the antisocial kids I'm talking about.
We were hanging out at the laundromat.
The bowling alley is where I hung out.
Yeah.
In the parking lot of the bowling alley, you get stoned, listen to Boston and Foghat.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm older than you, aren't I?
No, same age.
Oh, okay. I thought I was older than you.
Well, 70. I didn't get my license till 77. What year did you get?
76.
Hey, I got to interrupt 76. This. We got to take another break.
Okay.
Break or end the show? Break? Oh, we got to take a quick break. It's just some technical
stuff. Oh, this will be part two. So, we're not ending this show.
I'm not done yet.
Be right back.
Okay, and now we're back and you guys are eating.
We are.
Hell yeah,
we are. Come on.
Okay.
So what do you want to do? Read an email?
So I want to read the thing about the heroin because we did a couple pots and let me read this heroin one. Yeah. Please help. My friend over, and this is
first name
Lily,
first name,
Lily
first name.
L, and it says, please.
Again, we can't, unfortunately, the way the laws are, we can't specifically address her thing. So
Because Drew, listen to the letter. At the end, it says it's a matter of life or death. Do you think I want to be held accountable for this?
Not about being held accountable. It's about what's legally appropriate and ethically.
Please help. My friend of over 30 years is an alcoholic. Her husband is alcoholic. Her two boys, 25 and 24, are both addicted to heroin.
Oh,
her nephew just passed away from an overdose. His brother just left another rehab with, AMA.
Yeah.
It's a nightmare. She refused to get help because she doesn't think she needs it. Still who in is denial. That?
The mom?
Her friend. Yeah, the mom of all this.
And mom's the alcoholic, right?
Yeah, mom's...
Okay, so what do you do with... Let's go to back up. There's...
Well, there's something... Why? When I read the letter, I thought of my family. There's a lot of alcoholism in my family, and... But I was a heroin addict, and
that
was really bad. So what I see is the mom is thinking, yeah, I drink or I have a drinking problem, but these boys
are real addicts.
Yeah, these are the real problem.
I'm afraid generally in this country, we've forgotten about alcohol. You know what I mean?
We have
so much trouble with pills and everything else that alcohol's like, okay, we can deal with that.
Go have a drink.
Let them go for a little while. It's all right.
And it's sad.
We've forgotten how dangerous, how it progresses, how it goes on, you know, across a lifespan.
It manifests in the next generation in heroin addiction.
That's
well,
right.
Well, no.
Well, it can.
Not
that's what this is. That's what happened in my family.
Yeah, but we had...
Because
had a sister mom.
you did.
That's how that happened.
But if you're
that's
looking for...
That's why Mac and I could get along so good. So one time, I never told you this, I asked her if it was my dad who raised me, my grandfather, and she said, how dare you, Bobby? And she slapped my face. What does that mean?
Ooh. Wow.
Holy moly. Let's not get into it further than that.
Wow.
That's
wow.
Wow.
How dare
from
you.
Mackenzie Phillips.
So, Bob, let me understand. So why are you antisocial? Why are you antisocial?
Right. Well, exactly.
What creates that? Yeah. So, but alcohol is, you know, very, very serious problem. It can have massive, but you are not on the kind of a clock that you are with heroin where your life is like imminently in danger.
But with the genetic manifestation, right? So you have parents that are alcoholic.
Right, that's the gene.
That's the gene, but it can manifest in heroin because that's what's in front of them.
Well, I would argue, hold on. I would argue, and this is what I was going to say when you said, well, the mom has to, no. The dad's probably a raging perpetrator of God knows what. Mom is a severe codependent and not really available emotionally. And then they're both drunk. They're both, when they're using, who knows what they're like. And that's traumatic. And so then you get heroin.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
I get it. But the thing that's interesting to me is alcoholism,
and by
still
the, way,
the number one destroyer in America.
With cigarettes, yes.
Yes.
Number one, number two.
But... cause all the violence, domestic violence,
car accidents.
You know, it's some heroin addicts, some meth addicts, but alcoholism number one at domestic violence, right?
Absolutely,
number one with car accidents.
Well, I'm just maybe meth is number one domestic violence.
With domestic violence, you would say
meth is pretty bad with domestic. But
anyway, it's such a small
percentage
of the population is abusing that drug.
Yes, point is.
I think that population is growing.
The meth group?
Absolutely.
It waxes and wanes.
I'm seeing a lot of...
I know, it's
but
back.
What the
I
letter
know.
Describes kind of is this chaotic alcoholic couple, probably my age, that have these heroin addict kids. And I know that mother is putting aside her problems to focus melodramatically on the boys.
I would argue that now...
Histrionically melodramatic.
I would argue that she uses that justification for not dealing with her stuff.
Well, wouldn't you need a cocktail now and again
right.
if
how
you have two heroin
right.
addict
how
sons?
Am I supposed to deal with this? It makes, right.
I hate to trivialize it, but you really would need. And what do you need, Drew? You need people, and you need love, and you need support. But alcohol is what's in the refrigerator that seems to do a version of that, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, the chaos that's going on in America, everybody thinks it's a small percentage. It's a huge swath across America.
And it really, you know, when I look at it, it's that we got to do something about our families, man. We got to.
But I just want to say, when we're talking dysfunctional families, we're talking about Mac and Bob's families.
Yeah.
Yeah, you guys, yeah. I mean...
Well, we turned out all right.
Well, that's what I was going to say.
Eventually.
I've always had a lot of compassion.
You walk through it. You got through it, but it's extraordinary.
Well, and the thing is that I love about that, Bob, is that we're not hoarding our wellness to ourselves. We're actually trying to share it with other people.
And both of you had gotten to a place where you aren't, you know, when you really get over trauma, you start accepting what is sick in the other person that was the perpetrator, or you know, all the stuff that was going on there. You do actually have empathy for them. You still have all the other anger and hatred and misery and all whatever else they did to you, but you have some empathy, and that's a tall order. So you have, you know, an understanding.
Can you,
I'm so sorry.
Once you stop being a victim, you kind of have to have compassion.
Well,
and you start to understand it. Like, I was definitely a victim running around, like, you know. But once I got kind of on the other side of it, I could see, like, everybody's fucked up in one way or another. Yeah. Everybody, it just keeps going on and on.
You just had a very
But
big
here's
dose.
How that anger manifests before you get to this kind of place. It's like, oh, F you. Watch me now. I'll kill me. Yeah. I will burn it down to punish you for what you did to me.
It's a weird acting out, isn't it?
It's a weird acting out. And then when it
and
shifts.
And if I'm dying, will you come rescue me?
And exactly. It shifts.
Well, when it shifts, you recognize it as, wow, I was seriously punishing myself in order to get back at someone who didn't give a shit.
Before we wrap this up, did you have some sort of shift sitting in the chair talking to Oprah?
I was so scared of her.
But I feel like something
she's a vicious monster, in my opinion. So like,
well,
whatever.
She helped back. That's all I care about.
She did help me. My shift came with EMDR.
It's an eye movement therapy. People don't know what EMDR. Look up EMDR. It's excellent trauma therapy.
I didn't do it with the eyes. I did it with the little zzz
or whatever. Yeah. However, it's some sort of it's accessing deeper brain systems.
Deeper
that,
brain
that you
systems.
Can't get at by yourself or even by sort of traditional psychotherapy.
And
it
kind of makes the trauma live in a different place in your limbic system.
Yep.
And so that it's not constantly being re-stimulated.
Let me re-say it.
Say it the way.
The trauma lives in your body, in your autonomic system. It's mm-hmm. It's like you're being re-traumatized all the time. It's sort of a weird memory that we have that remains in our body. And as such, it's cut off from our more conscious processes, even our emotional processes sometimes. It's so deeply bodily based. And what EMDR and other trauma therapies allow you to do is to access it. So it becomes part of a whole of who you are.
So integrate.
I
didn't do EMDR, but that's what it is. It is a part of the whole of who I am.
Yeah. And as such...
I'm not scared of it.
Well, and as such, you can use your mature, healthy parts of yourself to regulate and talk to those other parts and be as opposed to be walled off from it.
Right.
And so you start to become an integrated whole. Literally, the wiring of your brain changes. You That's wire right. into that part of the brain.
You know what I've noticed? And I'm not bragging, but I had this weird business offer last week, and I didn't even have that junky response like, oh, I could do this, and then all the corrective shit like, no, you couldn't, Bob. I didn't even have it. I was like, oh, I wouldn't want to be involved in something like that.
Yeah, that's good.
That's amazing. Isn't that right?
Peace out, baby.
Peace out.
With that, we will say goodbye. Max, such a privilege. Always
love you guys
so
much.
Yeah, we love you too. I'm just so happy for you and just see you looking so great.
We didn't even mention she won the Sober Person of the Year award the other day.
Really?
And I was there. I got to give the prayer.
You did. It was the Experience, Strength, and Hope Award. He was amazing.
I did the opening prayer. Like, I don't know what kind of prayer it was. It was mostly like, let's get it together, people.
Three of us are going to finish up here. We'll see you next time.
Bye-bye.
Bye.